This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. In this last week of spring, we took an extensive look at Virginia's environment as part of our series this month. That included a deep dive into the prospects for wind energy off Virginia's shoreline and what we might learn from Denmark. And we'll get to that extended report from Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Houseman in just a little bit. But first, there's been a lot of buzz about something called colony collapse disorder that's causing honeybee colonies to disappear in massive numbers. And that affects all of us. Honeybees are a vital component in the production of lots of crops, ranging from okra to kiwis to cotton. WMRA's Carol Lofton took a look at the factors affecting bee health, how bees are doing in Virginia, and what's being done to save them.
"Caution, honeybees working," reads a sign beside seven hives on the Eastern Mennonite University campus in Harrisonburg. The hives are part of the university's overall efforts towards sustainability, which also included turning the hill on which the hives sit into a wildflower meadow several years ago. Seminary professor Kenton Durstein owns and manages the hives, with occasional help from undergraduate students.
"I think to understand the plight of the bees is to understand how all the factors interact, and that it's not any one, it's probably three or four factors when they come together and interact, create the problem for the bees."
Although not a professional beekeeper, Durstein has kept beehives for almost 50 years. He said when he first started, beekeeping was easy because there were few threats to the bees. Now, beekeepers are losing up to 40% of their hives, according to an annual survey conducted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Those in Virginia have fared even worse than the national average, with beekeepers losing around 45% of their hives annually. The losses are of concern not only to beekeepers, but to farmers who rely on the bees to pollinate their crops. Honeybee pollination alone is credited with adding more than $15 billion of value to the agricultural crops, because without bees, food production would plummet. In 2014, the bee crisis even caught the eye of President Obama, who created an interagency task force to develop a strategy to promote the health of honeybees and other pollinators. The task force published their strategy last month with the following goals: reduce honeybee colony losses during the winter to no more than 15% within 10 years. Increase eastern population of the monarch butterflies to 225 million butterflies by 2020. And restore or enhance 7 million acres of land for pollinators over the next 5 years. They hope to achieve these goals through research, habitat restoration, education, and public outreach. In recent years, the main suspect for the bee crisis has been pesticides. But experts, such as Virginia State apiarist Keith Tigner, says that colony collapse disorder is the result of many interrelating factors stressing the bees all at once.
"Colony collapse disorder is very difficult to get a handle on because we can't identify a single source of the cause for the decline, the rapid decline in their colonies that is associated with the colony collapse disorder. What we're looking at is a number of different maladies or environmental, genetic, behavioral differences that have caused the bees to not perform as well as they have in the past. And so we're seeing that in colonies that do express the colony collapse disorder, we're seeing a very rapid decline in the population over a matter of weeks."
Tigner lists some of the factors attributed to the disorder: pests, including parasites, the decrease in genetic diversity in the bees themselves, malnutrition from a lack of biodiversity, pathogens, neonicotinoid pesticides, and possibly climate change.
"All of these things coming in together have caused this decline in the bees, and it's very difficult for the beekeepers to recover from that."
At EMU, Durstein indicates his hives on the hill. He said while he does lose some hives every year, all seven of the ones here made it through the winter and seem to be doing well.
"The reason I think that these hives have done so well here is the biodiversity on campus and even in within a mile in Parkview. You know, a lot of people have shrubs and, you know, from early spring, there's always something blooming around here that I can watch. Pollens from different flowers have different food content. And not all pollen has the same nutritional value for bees. And then another factor is they wintered on their own honey. And most commercial beekeepers really remove most of the honey and feed high fructose corn syrup for the bees to survive, get through the winter, or when they need it.
In a 2013 article, researchers at the University of Illinois reported that while high fructose corn syrup itself is not toxic to bees, it doesn't provide the nutrients that bees need, which both contributes to malnutrition and weakens the bees' immune response to other potential toxins, such as parasites and pesticides. The substitution of high fructose corn syrup for the bees' own honey could be another one of the many factors contributing to the decline. Despite the numbers, Tignor is optimistic about the future of beekeeping in Virginia. He said the total number of Virginia beekeepers is on the rise. The increase is due to regular people with other jobs who hear about the crisis and want to do their part to fix the problem, which at this point may mean simply being present with the bees and figuring out what is causing them to fail. For WMRA News, I'm Carol Lofton.
With about $47 million from the federal government, Virginia has said it would partner with Dominion Power to build a demonstration project for offshore wind power. But the utility now says it can't get started because installing a couple of turbines is too expensive. Meanwhile, Denmark reports it is getting nearly 40% of its power from wind. So what can we learn from the Danes? And what can Virginia do to kick Dominion into higher gear? Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman went to Denmark to find out.
Denmark is known as the birthplace of Hans Christian Andersen, who wrote many of Europe's favorite fairy tales.
It was a glorious day like today, out in the middle of countryside, just like this.
The Ugly Duckling, The Princess and the Pea, The Emperor's New Clothes, and other childhood favorites all sprang from Andersen's pen. The country's also known for the statue of a mermaid that graces Copenhagen's harbor, for the profound thoughts of the philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, and for strong modern design. In short, Denmark is a land of imagination. Add to that its location, near the windiest parts of the North Sea, and you begin to understand why a country of just 5.6 million people has moved boldly into the business of wind power. Jan Heileberg is CEO of the Danish Wind Association.
The story about wind in Denmark is driven for sure by pioneers, but also by politics. We, back in the 70s, during the oil crisis, decided that we won't be dependent on fossil fuels in the future. So therefore, we have been developing wind for more than 30 years.
Just beyond Copenhagen's harbor, 20 turbines spin in the wind, supplying power to city residents, creating no pollution and costing nothing for fuel. That's an important point for Europe, where it costs more than $3 a day for every man, woman, and child to buy and import coal, oil, and gas. When the Middelgrunden wind farm was built in 2000, it was the largest in the world. Today, just 15 years later, wind energy companies are building turbines three or four times bigger, more than 650 feet tall.
Have a look towards the blades. The rotor has a diameter of 164 meters. That's more than the length of 1.5 football fields.
At this year's meeting of the European Wind Energy Association, visitors had the chance to stand on one of them through a virtual reality display created by the Danish wind company MHI Vestas. Special goggles and headphones allowed convention goers to look out on a vast expanse of ocean and on the wind farm the company plans to build in British waters.
Have a look to your right. That's Liverpool, about 10 kilometers away. The 32 turbines that we'll install here are able to power more than 180,000 homes. I hope you had a great experience, and have a nice flight back.
Like the UK and Denmark, Virginia has great potential for offshore wind, a point stressed during a 2013 interview with Saifur Rahman, director of the Virginia Tech Advanced Research Institute.
Virginia is one of the few states in the country which has very high quality offshore wind. Our continental shelf is quite shallow, unlike California and the West Coast.
Dominion Virginia Power has leased land for an offshore wind farm with as many as 600 turbines, and the state can get $47 million federal dollars to help construct a small demonstration project. That was supposed to be up and running by 2017, but Dominion is now pushing the date back, saying the project could cost over $400 million, far more than it wants to spend. Could we perhaps do without this early research? Maybe consult the Danes. What challenges have they faced and conquered? Denmark has been building wind farms since the early 90s, figuring out which turbines work best offshore, what impact their construction might have on marine life, and how to weather storms in the North Sea. Engineers have also mastered the art of managing a grid using fluctuating sources of power, wind and solar, also known as photovoltaic, or PV.
If it gets out of balance too much, you'll have a blackout.
That's Peter Jorgensen, vice president of Energinet, the company that transmits power to Denmark and three other countries.
It was easy to run big power plants fired with coal, oil, or natural gas. You could adjust the generation so that it balanced with the demand. But today you have a large share of wind power, PV, and you still have to keep the system balanced.
He gazes through glass into a large, quiet control room where five people sit at computer screens and watch an entire wall showing the grid they oversee in collaboration with their neighbors.
You have a map of the whole of Denmark with the interconnectors to Norway in the north, Sweden to the east, and Germany to the south.
Key to the success of Energinet are sophisticated computer programs that manage the grid minute by minute. Also essential is cooperation with a country that can generate hydroelectric power when the wind isn't blowing. Runbjerg Nielsen is a spokesman for Denmark's main energy company.
Norway has a huge capacity for hydropower, which they can relatively easy turn up and down.
And it turns out Virginia could be in a similar situation. Based on remarks made in 2013 by Seifer Rahman, director of the Virginia Tech Advanced Research Institute, our Norway is in Bath County.
Dominion has what is called pumped storage hydro facility. That means they can pump the water at night or during low demand period, hold the water in the upper reservoir, and when the peak shows up next day, they'll let the water come down and run hydro turbines. In fact, Dominion has the biggest pump storage plant in the world.
So if we had offshore turbines, excess power produced on windy days could be used to pump water up. And when offshore winds left a gap in our grid, the facility in Bath could fill it. But Dominion, which is heavily invested in nuclear, coal, and gas-burning power plants, is moving slowly toward building offshore wind facilities. At an international conference on wind power, we spoke with Henry Schumann, vice president of a Danish company that builds offshore wind farms. He recently visited Virginia as part of a delegation, hoping to land new business.
Well, in Richmond, we learned that power production is dominated by Dominion, so everything hinges on what will happen with Dominion. And, of course, Dominion, being in a monopolized situation, has maybe not the right incentives to move ahead to the speed that the market would like to see.
He thinks a wind farm could be up and running off Virginia's coast by 2020. But Dominion isn't making any promises. In fact, despite the exchange of more than a dozen emails, the utility's chief spokesman would not agree to speak with us. Virginia is blessed with 112 miles of coastline. 27 miles out, the water's still relatively shallow, making it ideal for construction of wind turbines. And there's usually a steady ocean breeze.
Offshore wind blows about 70% of the time, whereas in the central part of the country, 30 or 40% of the time.
That's John Wellinghoff, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He was appointed by President George W. Bush, continued to serve during the Obama years, and is now a lobbyist for green energy companies. He doesn't see Virginia moving forward with development of offshore wind because it's expensive. And by law, one company, Dominion Virginia Power, controls most of the market.
If we're going to take advantage of the new technologies that are out there, not just wind and solar, but also technologies that can help the grid operate more effectively, can help consumers control their costs, then I think we have to restructure the system.
It's hard to imagine Virginia's legislature opening the energy production market to competition. If you disregard donations from political parties, Dominion is the state's largest campaign contributor. And restructuring the market for electric power is no guarantee. Many coastal states have done so, but only one, Rhode Island, is building offshore turbines. From Charlottesville, Elisa Wood edits microgridknowledge.com. She says offshore wind is expensive to build, and investors are hesitant after seeing what happened to Cape Wind. Supporters of that $2.6 billion project in Nantucket Sound applied for their first permit in 2001. But opponents said it would spoil their view. could harm commercial fishing and pose a navigational hazard.
A very small number of very wealthy people have blocked that project now for many, many years, spending tens of millions of dollars themselves and costing the developer the same amount of money. It's very difficult to get investor interest because of the chill created by Cape Wind.
Here in Virginia, the turbines would be so far offshore that the view would not be an issue. And the European experience suggests no harm to fish, birds, or marine mammals. But there's another impediment. Rates for electricity in New England are relatively high. Again, energy expert Elisa Wood.
Where pricing is high, we see more innovation because they're looking for the solutions.
But Dominion offers fairly inexpensive power thanks to nuclear plants paid off long ago and cheap supplies of coal and natural gas. By law, if Dominion wants to bill its customers for offshore wind turbines, it must get approval from state regulators, and they must consider cost. Jason Lehman is an industry editor at SNL Financial.
They would have a very tough time justifying to state regulators recouping investment in offshore wind when there are other cheaper sources of generation available at the moment.
The cost of building offshore wind farms would likely come down if this country were to do more of it. But because Rhode Island is the only builder, there are few companies with the expertise and equipment to do the job. That might explain why, when Dominion asked for bids to build a couple of turbines off Virginia Beach, only one firm submitted a qualified bid, and it was at least $145 million more than the utility was prepared to spend. No word yet on when, but the company has said it will meet with members of the Virginia Offshore Wind Development Authority to discuss how to lower costs. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Now for something completely different. Apologies to Monty Python. Almost all of the equipment humans send to space eventually becomes inoperable and then is left there as junk. But what if some of that material could be redeemed or at least remain as an indefinite testament to human beauty and culture rather than just trash? Carol often met the JMU art professor and sculptor and his art project that will soon be headed for the moon.
The sculpture is called the Moon Arts Ark. It will be sent to the moon on the Carnegie Mellon University rover as part of the Google Lunar X competition. The rover is set to launch in 2017. The Ark is the brainchild of well-known space artist Lowry Burgess and is meant to be a kind of time capsule for future generations. The Ark will contain pieces of poetry, music, data, and art that have been specially commissioned for the project. The project team aims to pack as much information as possible into the 6 ounces of payload they are allotted on the rover, which is tiny. Tiny design is where Mark Rooker from James Madison University comes in. Rooker is a metalsmith with expertise in micrometalworking. He has been commissioned to design the structural components of the sculpture. Rooker holds up his contribution to the sculpture, 4 delicately woven components of wire, titanium plates, and gemstones. Altogether, the pieces are only about 2 inches high. They are dwarfed in his large hands.
Well, one of the nice things about putting art on the moon is that it will be there in 2,000 years. My hope is that in 2,000 years, there'll be people there to see the art, to experience it, interact with it. Part of my interest in the space program, part of my love of science fiction has always been that it's a very hopeful genre at its heart. That's part of the charm of doing a project like this is that it is by its nature a hopeful thing. You know, you're hoping that when you put something on the moon that there'll be people there to see it in the future.
Long after the rover and its lander are obsolete, the Ark will remain waiting for the next generation of explorers to come and find it. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Finally, we've all seen stray dogs, but there's one teenager actually doing something about the problem. In the United States, 56% of dogs who enter animal shelters are euthanized, according to the American Humane Society. But one Rockingham County teen is fighting that statistic one dog at a time. And Carol Lofton got that story, too.
It was late winter when Laura Birchfield saw the dog outside of her car window on Route 11. He was a German Shepherd, alone and frantic. Her parents wouldn't let her keep the dog right away, so she had to take him to the local pound where he was put on stray hold.
I called every day to be sure he was okay and to be sure if he had found his home yet. and nobody claimed him, and I went and got him the next Saturday, and we fostered him for a few weeks.
That was in February of last year. Since then, Birchfield, who is a rising sophomore at Turner Ashby High School, and her family have fostered 14 dogs.
It just sort of connected with me. It just felt like something that I really wanted to do. Even for the rest of my life, it felt like it's something that I want to stick with.
Birchfield fosters most of her dogs through Augusta Dog Adoptions, a nonprofit that takes dogs from the local shelters in high kill pounds and places them in volunteer foster homes. She said the organization is always looking for new foster parents.
The best thing about fostering is when I get to pull them out of the shelter and see that look on their face of freedom and seeing them finally feel happy. And the worst thing is probably when I bring them home and they're so scared and you know they have been through something really bad.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, and an anonymous donor. And you, too, can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org. You'll find stories from the WMRA newsroom and more information at our website, WMRA.org. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll see you in the morning.